WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. A new Pew Research poll found that the American public has become divided along political ideological lines in the last 20 years, with Republicans and Democrats viewing each other with increasing mistrust and hostility. It found that 36% of Republicans view the Democratic Party as a threat to the nation's well-being. And conversely, 27% of Democrats felt the same way about the GOP. In the last 20 years, according to Pew, liberals and conservatives increasingly live in different worlds with people who think like them. We want to explore our politically fractured nation and what that means for voters, for lawmakers, and for political discourse. And we have two guests who have joined us in this hour of Radio Times. Brenda Nyhan is assistant professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College, where his research focuses on misperceptions about politics. He writes for the Upshot blog for the New York Times and joins us from Dartmouth studios. Brenda Nyhan, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And also with us is James Peterson. He's director of Africana Studies, also associate professor of English at Lehigh University, founder of Hip Hop Scholars, and MSNBC contributor. And James Peterson, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well. Brendan, let me begin with you, because I know you have taken a long view at a public opinion. Is there anything new about living in a country where people view each other with mistrust and hostility when it comes to politics?
Well, I wouldn't say it's a new phenomenon. Politics has always been conflictual, but we do have this. We are at this particular moment where we're starting to come to grips as a country with what it means to have not just a polarized country, but a country where ideology and party are so closely linked. And that is a new phenomenon, and it's one that seems very different to people from the 20th century norm of a kind of more bipartisan politics that many of our political institutions often harken back to.
But what you're saying is that people who live in worlds that really believe very different things about the country, about some of the issues that face us?
Yeah, especially the most politically engaged people. You know, it's important not to overstate the extent to which this applies to everybody, right? Lots of people don't care very much about politics, don't think about it very much, and they're likely to be a lot less polarized. But for the people who care the most, which are also the ones who are most engaged, most likely to contribute, most likely to vote, most likely to contact their elected officials, those folks are becoming increasingly polarized. And they're the ones, of course, who elected officials respond to because they're involved in the political system.
How do you see the divide or the polarization?
Yeah, I would agree. I think there are different factors that inform some of the ways in which people polarize. So being able to access politicians and having access to them through cable news and through social media. And the Pew research will sort of proliferate into different avenues where they're going to explore some of these things. But I think these things are already informing the data that we have, which is to say, it's a little bit easier to email your congressperson than it was to sort of reach out to them via letter. We can sort of track politicians and track what they're saying. We have much more access to them, and I think that informs the polarization. But I would also say that, you know, there are certain, you know, flashpoints, certain watershed issues that help to reify the polarization. You know, if you think about access to health care, if you think about the social safety net, you think about war policy and intervention and drone policy. There are lots of ways in which our economy in the 21st century, the way that we prosecute the war on terror in the 21st century, the way that we think about health care, women's rights in the 21st century has changed a bit, and that feeds the polarization.
But why do you think the middle is not as engaged as the edges?
Well, two reasons. One, people in the middle are pragmatic and less ideological, so they're more invested in trying to get things done and kind of have a utopian sense of what politics is. People in the middle are also disenchanted with the political process because of the ways in which we see money overdetermining not just political campaigns but political issues. That kind of gets people to check out. And there are lots of reasons, right. But the center has been silent in too many ways along these lines, and I think that contributes to this study as well.
Do you see that as well, Brendan? The center has been quiet as the edges are more engaged?
Yeah, and that's a common pattern. You know, we tend to think about the political center as being this group of people with strong moderate views, but the general pattern for the political center is people who are disengaged. They're in the center because they're not very interested in politics. They don't pay much attention to it. And they often not just they often don't hold consistently moderate views. They hold a grab bag of liberal and conservative views because they haven't thought very much about politics, and so they don't have what we would think of as a consistent belief system. Now, that isn't to say it's right or wrong, but what it means is in practice they're largely sitting these things out, and that hasn't changed very much. The action is on the extremes, right? That's where the change has been. You know, the political center is disengaged, but the political center has always been disengaged. That's not a new phenomenon.
I want to go back to, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I think that we're a little bit more cynical about politics, and that's across the spectrum. And again, I think part of that is a result of, it's not just Citizens United, it's how campaigns have been funded, and it's the ways in which people perceive the issues that we talk about as being shaped by big mm-hmm. money in politics. That's not subject to change anytime in the near future, and so that cynicism underwrites some of that disengagement. Some of it, I think Brandon's right, some of it's just people check out because not everyone is as interested in politics as we are. And that's their right to be disengaged. But there is also a deep and abiding cynicism that just grows from I think, the ways in which money overdetermines our political issues.
Brendan, just picking up on that and going back to you, would you say then those people who are engaged politically and may view each other with a degree of suspicion, that they have their own places where they go get their news, where they go get their facts to build their political beliefs?
There's a tendency to do that. You know, I should say that this is a very contested point. People express that preference. So they express that preference in the Pew survey to a greater extent. If we put them in the lab, they'll be more likely to choose that story that's consistent with their political views. So we do have that tendency, people who have strong political views. At the same time, though, we get information from lots of different places, and the most sophisticated studies have tried to take into account all the different ways that information comes to you, shows that most people still have relatively diverse diets of information. So we're not fully siloed in echo chambers yet. Now, the reason to be concerned about this, though, again, is that the most politically engaged people may be also the most extreme and the most likely to construct these sorts of echo chambers, especially activists, donors, people like that who are especially influential in our political system. And if they're increasingly siloed, then you can have this problem of not only greater extremity, but something that I'm interested in, which is a greater likelihood of engaging of factual misinformation, of not getting corrective information that's being unable to penetrate that echo chamber.
Go ahead, James.
There's a tremendous amount of meta political discourse, and so if you're watching Fox, you'll see them sampling and engaging MSNBC. If you're watching MSNBC, you'll see them sampling and engaging Fox News. And so I think Brandon's right. The echo chamber theory is not as sound as it may seem. And if you watch Jon Stewart, he's going to have people from CNN through video clips from MSNBC and Fox on there. And so there is that overlap. But again, I would argue that the challenges for us in terms of having a healthier political discourse rest with the ways in which funding affects politics and the sort of political issues that we talk about, and the cynicism that I think emerges from that. Again, I would also argue that the construction of the political parties is quite different but also tricky. And so one thing about the Pew piece is that, you know, it's very difficult for me to conflate liberals and progressives with the Democratic Party.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right? Because I find that there are a lot of liberals who are way to the left of this president, and I don't think they have the same kind of vocalization in the political process as, say, the Tea Party does within the Republican Party. And so I'm not sure if those things are equivalent on both sides of the political spectrum.
Do you see that similarly, Brendan?
Well, this is what I would say. There is a difference, I think, between the two parties, but it's one that's changing, right? So that historically, the Democratic Party has been more of a coalition of self-identified liberals and moderates, and that applies both to the people who vote for the Democratic Party as well as the elected officials who are members. Whereas on the Republican side, especially in the modern era, there's been more of a consensus of conservatism, both among voters and among Republican politicians. So the fact that the Democrats have had this more heterogeneous coalition with more ideological diversity meant that they were often seen as more willing to compromise and things like that. But one of the things that the Pew study documents is that on the liberal side, you're seeing more movement of liberals who are tending in a direction of preferring greater ideological uniformity. Now, that we can have an argument about the exact extent to which that's equivalent to what we see on the Republican side, but the trend line there is towards the Democratic Party becoming more like the Republican Party in that sense.
But are you saying those people that are, say, let's say, to the left of the president, they want to stay with that party, or are they looking for another party, Brendan?
Well, I'm very dubious about third parties. They're very hard to get off the ground.
Apparently
we've had these
parties
for a long time, right? And there's a reason. It's extremely hard. The system is stacked to make it very difficult to overturn the two parties that
Even
are in power,
so,
right?
Yeah.
And then it took slavery and the Civil War, right, to change the party system the last time, and that was well over a century ago. So we shouldn't expect third parties on the horizon anytime soon. It's much more likely that these new energies will be funneled into the party, right? Just the way the Tea Party movement to a significant extent has been funneled into the Republican Party, the energy that exists on the liberal side will likely get funneled into the Democratic Party.
Let me toss something to you, James, and actually to you, Brendan, as well. And I'm thinking about the Affordable Care Act, which
right.
did get passed finally. This really was a Republican idea from the 1990s, and now many people call it Obamacare.
Right.
From your perspective, James, is that sort of the shift that you're talking about, something that was embraced by Republicans, now vilified by a large number of Republicans?
I do believe that the right has been very, very effective at pulling the American political spectrum to the right. But it's not just the right. I think that there's a sense of neoliberalism in the air, right, that privatization and free market policies are the best. And so when you look at privatization across the spectrum, remember, when I say big money in politics, that's not just Republicans, that's Democrats as well. And I think that, from my political perspective, has shifted things a little bit to the right. I think the other major factor, and the data in this current iteration of the study doesn't show this yet, but I think in later iterations of it, they'll parse some of this out, is that demographics are also changing how people see politics. And so when you think about something like the Affordable Care Act,
right.
you know, there's an important ideology amongst the right wing, especially extreme right wing conservatives, that the social safety net is something that is, for the most part, a giveaway to people of color, to undocumented folk. And so that sort of the ways in which demographics and demographics shifts in America are shaping and informing political ideas and political ideologies is very, very important. Again, not reflected so much here, but I think when they dial down a bit, you'll see more of that, and that will become more pronounced in how we think about these extremes.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies, Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University. Also with us, Brendan Nyhan, Assistant Professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. We are jumping off this new poll from the Pew Research Center, finding that Americans have become much more divided along a political ideological lines. And we want to hear from you. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from the new Wells Fargo Propel World American Express card, designed to bring the world within reach for Wells Fargo customers. Details at a local Philadelphia area branch or wellsfargo.com/propel. Wells Fargo, the world is open. Keep exploring.
Whether you're just waking up or you're on your commute, the news is always happening. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Jennifer Lynn. WHYY and NPR's reporters are covering the stories around the block and across the globe that will fuel your day and keep you informed.
So if your alarm is set to 90.9 or we're the first preset on your car's radio,
it's radio so vibrant you can almost see it.
And our reporters never take shortcuts.
Morning Edition, weekday mornings on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Lending seeds to gardeners is now a mission that public libraries have taken on to help save the best of the past.
You look at seed catalogs from 100 years ago and you see things that just don't exist anymore.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Amtrak, featuring PATripsByTrain.com. offering train packages to destinations along Amtrak's Keystone Service Line. More information on available excursion packages at patripsbytrain.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen with a question. Do you have a close friend whose political beliefs are very different from your own? Well, if a new Pew Research poll is correct, the chances are that answer is no. But if your answer is yes or no, we do want to hear from you. And that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Talking with James Peterson and Brendan Nyhan about the political divide in this country. Brendan, going back to you, and you referenced silos, as did this Pew Research poll, but how do we effectively talk with one another if we don't have friends who have different beliefs from ours, and we want to develop that kind of a friendship? How do we talk to each other in a way that we don't end up at each other's throats?
That's a good question. We need institutions that promote that. We need places that bring people together from different walks of life. Workplaces are like that for some people. But to the extent that for instance, states and cities are better sorted politically, you might have less diversity even at your workplace than you might have in the past, right? So people talk about, for instance, World War II, the draft. We're not going to have a war in order to promote better conversations across political lines, but that's the kind of institution that brought people together, right, from all different sorts of backgrounds, right? So, an example along these lines is something like AmeriCorps, or you could imagine different sorts of experiences like that might bring people together. It's harder to just reach out to random people, and a lot of the institutions we have that facilitate discussion and debate are very polarized, right? Talking through the media, internet comment boards, social media, right? A lot of those are not exactly facilitating careful deliberation, right? They're brawling and attacking each other and not the kind of debate we'd like to have. So, we need to create better situations for people to engage.
Well, I mean, people are itching for a fight, yes?
Yeah, this
James
is what
Peterson?
I mean by trying to draw distinctions between the 20th century and the 21st century. And so technology really does shape things. Like, for example, drone warfare presents different issues in terms of how we prosecute the war on terror, right? The NSA collecting data presents different issues about surveillance, how we deliver health care. You know what I mean? So there are lots of ways in which technology and advancements in technology shape things. If you think about, and I'm laughing because if you look at any political argument on Twitter, right, you can see the limitations.
I don't do those things, but go ahead.
Well, I watch them. I don't try to participate in them. I watch them because it's really interesting to see people try to engage in what should be sophisticated political dialogue and discourses in 140 characters. But the limitations of Twitter, the form, reflect the limitations of our political discourse, which is people are much more interested in one-upmanship and quippy one-liners. And look, I'm a media person, so I'm as guilty of this as anyone. But we have this sort of soundbite culture that informs political discourse. And I think if you watch any political debate on Twitter, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about.
Indeed. Brendan, let me go back to you and put something else on the table here, which is related to some of the research that you have done. Why do people believe false information, things that are not true? What's the appeal?
Well, in a lot of cases, it's because it's consistent with what we want to believe about the world, right? And especially when it comes to politics and controversial issues and figures in politics, we tend to have what's called a confirmation bias. When we hear something that confirms what we are predisposed to believe, we apply less scrutiny to that information. And then conversely, when we're told that something we want to believe isn't true, we're much more skeptical of it, right? We're trying to think of reasons to reject that correction and say, this isn't true. And the combination of those factors means that polarization creates the conditions where you can get these very widespread political misperceptions along partisan or ideological lines. So Republicans are much more likely to think Barack Obama is a Muslim or not born in this country. Democrats were much more likely to think the Bush administration was involved with or allowed the 9/11 attacks, for instance. We're much more susceptible to those sorts of distortions in what people think they know about politics, and those can be very destructive to even, you know, the starting point for a debate, let alone actually getting through to talk about policy with a shared kind of factual basis for what the two sides think is true about the world.
You want to add something?
Yeah, this is tricky. Again, I don't want us to delve into false equivalencies. If you just take those two examples, you know, the role of the Bush administration in 9/11 is a conspiracy theory. If you watch the documentary Loose Change, you see how they try to deal with it. But it's not xenophobic. It's not based on what I think of as some of the problems that arise in political discourses that stem directly from demographic shifts, both in the United States and around the world. Whereas the sort of Islamophobia and the ideas that somehow President Barack Obama is not American, those things also conspiracy theories, but they're connected and related to what I think is sort of the fear that some Americans have about the shifting demographics of this nation.
The fear because we have a black president?
Yes, he reflects race? That. Not only does he embody it, but he reflects it in terms of the political coalition that reelected him, especially, but also put him in office in the first place.
Do you agree with that? I mean, how much role do you think, Brendan, race plays in people's belief systems?
Well, there's unfortunately very persuasive research by a political scientist named Michael Tesler that the Obama administration has seen the most racially – politics has been very polarized by race. People's opinions about Barack Obama are much more closely linked to their racial views than they were previously, right? So we have this racial dynamic, this kind of subterranean to our politics under the Obama administration, and that's a very delicate and difficult thing to talk about, of course, because
sure.
That's not to say you can't have legitimate objections to Barack Obama or his policies. You can. It's not saying that you can't oppose him without being a racist. Of course you can, right? But it's just indisputably true empirically that people's scores on something called the racial resentment scale are more closely linked to how they feel about Obama and his policies than when you substitute in a white Democratic politicians.
Yeah.
Right? That's just an empirical fact that's been shown a number of times.
It is. I would just add to that so he embodies it, but it's also important to note that the electorate that put him in office also reflects that as well. There are actually changing demographics, the increase of minority population, the fact that minorities won't be minorities in this nation at a certain point. I think the real demographics of that also inform those ideologies.
Brendan, let me go back to you, and then I do want to get to our callers here, just picking up on something you said about confirmation bias, that we seek out information that confirms what we believe anyway. And if we live in more sort of increasingly siloed neighborhoods or friendship groups, does that sort of reinforce even further what it is that we believe?
It could. I mean, there is evidence that when you deliberate about an issue with people who are like-minded, you end up in a more extreme place than you started. So there is a danger there. Now, again, you know, I want to be careful. The research that's looked at geographic segregation, the results are more by politics. The results are more mixed than it might seem. So in a lot of ways, you know, we should take something like this report as not saying definitively that we are fully siloed and fully echo chambered. We're not. But also to think carefully about where we are as a country. And one point, Marty, I hope we can put on the table is
sure.
that our institutions don't function very well with highly polarized politics. So the challenge we face as a country, to my mind, is how we make our government work, which is where it's very easy to block action. Determined minorities can very easily block action. There's so many ways to slow down the mechanics of government under the constitutional system we have in this country. So it's difficult to combine that with the highly polarized politics of today. And that's something that, of course, we've seen in the politics of the last 5 to 10 years.
And that's Brendan Nyhan, assistant professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College, joining us from their studios. And here in our Philadelphia studio, James Peterson, director of Africana Studies, associate professor of English at Lehigh University. And we have a lot of callers that want to join our conversation at 1-888-477-7949. We also have an email from Barbara saying the middle independents are not disengaged. They are disenfranchised by the two parties. I'm looking at you, James Peterson.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with that. The disenfranchisement, though, I think is a result of, again, cynicism from people who feel like money overdetermines what politics is. I think the corporatization of media and how politics is reported on reflects that. I think when you look at talk radio, present company excluded, I think people just feel as if the game is rigged. And that's, you know, that's not just about the Electoral College. That's about Citizens United and the ways in which big money really shapes what we talk about in politics. I mean, there are people who look at stories that we cover or things that we talk about, and they don't understand how and why it's relevant. And that creates cynicism. So it's disenfranchisement by proxy, and the proxy here is money and politics. I want to go back to something a little bit earlier too.
Sure.
You know, one thing I would love to see with the Pew Research is to have a better understanding of how class impacts some of the data they have, because when you talk about people choosing where they want to live, remember there's a disproportionate amount of Democrats who are lower class, working class, people of color, who actually can't choose so much about where they want to live. And so when you talk about ideological silos, you have to think about that, how that one piece of data informs the other.
I wonder, too, Brendan, even picking up on the email, and we had a primary here in Pennsylvania, other states having primaries. We have like 20% of voters.
Less than 100,000 people turned out
voting
to vote for the Cantor. The big Cantor, you know, he lost his seat.
Right.
Less than 100,000 people voted in that.
Right. And yet, you know, as a result of Cantor's getting booted in the fall, this whole issue of immigration apparently is off the table. So, yes, people are not engaged, but if they don't vote, you know, we have, I guess, the system that we have.
Right. I mean, you know, I want to say a couple of things, Marty. I mean, one is that the primary system, the evidence actually in terms of how much it drives polarization is quite mixed. Okay, so it doesn't seem to be the primary factor in what's driving the polarization in our politics, at least from the social science research that's been done. And in terms of why centrists are sitting things out, you know, we should be clear. I think that this is a pattern that predates a lot of the factors that were discussed, including, you know, the massive amounts of money that are now spent in politics, Citizens United, et cetera. Right. This is a long term phenomenon that goes back a long way. Now, that doesn't mean that those folks aren't feeling disenfranchised. They may be alienated by our politics, but centrists have always been uninterested in our politics. I mean, that's the persistent pattern that we've seen. And so what I think we should be skeptical of is the idea that somehow that's going to change. We have decades of history to suggest that it's very unlikely to. The party system is where the action is, and that's what's driving our politics in the way that we've seen recently.
And Pennsylvania is a closed primary state, so
right.
You know, it makes it very difficult for third-party candidates to even get on the ballot. Let me get Andrea from Malvern to join us on Radio Times. Andrea, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I certainly agree with both of your very informed guests. I find, as a committee person in my area, there's a tremendous laziness. People resent being asked to get informed. They don't want to read. They just quote whatever cable news show they watch. And if you question them, they can't back up what they're saying. And I don't know how we move off that.
Well, Andrew, let me give James Peterson a chance. I mean, she's saying, she calls it laziness.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a different issue. I don't know how we move from that either. Remember that voters don't have to be informed to exercise their right to vote. That's not a prerequisite for voting. We want voters to be informed. We want folk to be proactive about seeking information about the issues. But that's not a prerequisite for voting in this nation. What I would like to see is for us to use the technology that's at our disposal to make voting easier, to make registration easier, to increase the sort of voting populace and provide sort of what I think of as technological incentives to make it easier for people to have access to the polls. I think that might, I think that is one of the counter forces that we have at our disposal to sort of work against the money that's in politics.
What do you think, Brendan, about Andrea's comment about people being lazy about informing themselves?
Well, I mean, I would say a couple things. First is, you know, we all are. It's hard work. And there isn't actually a very strong incentive to know very much about politics. Why would we expect people who are busy, who are trying to, you know, raise their families and work at their jobs and so forth, to memorize, you know, long lists of facts we expect them to know? That's very difficult. And I think we should be reasonable about what we expect from citizens. And in fact, because we're so polarized, it's actually much easier to participate meaningfully in politics than it used to be. In the old days, there were conservative Democrats and liberal Republicans, and when you use party to decide who to vote for, that wasn't necessarily as informative a cue as it is today, where it's quite predictive, right, of what they'll do in office. If you hear Democrat or Republican, you know a lot about what that person's going to believe and what they're going to do once they're in office. And that's actually why a lot of people thought polarization would be good. There were a lot of people in the mid-20th century who were having the exact opposite of the conversation we're having now. They were saying the parties are too similar. People can't tell the difference. It makes it very hard for people to figure out how to cast an informed vote. And we need parties that give them meaningful choices. There's a very famous report that came out of my profession, the American Political Science Association, calling for greater polarization. So now here we are, 60-plus years later, having the opposite conversation right. about, whoa, we're so polarized.
Right.
I think the things that we probably fail to anticipate the extent of the problem are on the extent to which factual beliefs would become polarized, and the extent to which our governing institutions weren't very well set up to handle this. But for the mass public, I'm not sure. I think we're being too hard on people. We need to help them make good choices. We shouldn't blame them for the system that we have.
But if people are polarized, James, it's hard to compromise, and it's hard to find that place in the middle where both sides can feel like they have won something.
Yeah, it is. And again, I'm of the belief that the middle has moved. You know, the goalposts have moved, and I think that is frustrating for people who identify as being progressive and or liberal. I agree that we have a responsibility, particularly those of us who are either political scientists or who are in the media as political pundits, to try to inform folk, and that we can't sort of, you know, I don't look down on people who don't study politics and don't follow politics the way that I do, because it's my job to do that. And so, if you know, that's, it's not fair, right? And so we do have sort of a responsibility to try to be informative and to try to be balanced. We just don't see a lot of that out there.
We have
Marty, can
go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No,
can I add
ahead.
One quick point
of
on
course.
This? So one thing to keep in mind actually about this that's really interesting, and it's something we didn't anticipate, is the extent to which having more information about politics can actually make some of these problems worse. And the reason is people who are more informed are much more informed relative to people who aren't interested in politics. They can get much more information than ever before, and the people who aren't interested in politics can avoid politics much more effectively than ever before, right? When there were only three TV channels, if you had the TV on, the news came on, right? And you couldn't help but see it, right? It's much easier to avoid that stuff now unless you're at an airport, right? So we have, we have actually a much more unequal society in terms of political information because of all the ways you can get better informed.
I mean, but people are willing to spend hours watching sports. I have no problem that whatsoever, and can cite facts and figures and history and all of that.
People can be informed if they want to be informed. Right. Again, it's just not a prerequisite for the system that we have. There's no law that says you have to watch all the news networks in order to vote. We want people to do that. But I think the onus, honestly, is on the media and the people who sort of run these new technologies, again, to try to craft a political discourse that's more open and that's more inviting, a little bit less echo chamberish. And I think, again, if we take that responsibility seriously enough, I think that the political discourse, the tone and tenor of the political discourse can change.
And that's James Peterson, again, Director of Africana Studies, Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University, founder of Hip Hop Scholars, joins us along with Brendan Nyhan, Assistant Professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College. He writes for the Upshot blog for the New York Times. We are talking about why can't we all get along, our fractured political discourse. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, introducing the first ever Lincoln MKC with the all-new available 2.3-liter EcoBoost powertrain. For the power and poise to handle any driving situation. More available at Lincoln.com.
I am John Oliver, and welcome to whatever this is.
On the next Fresh Air, John Oliver, the former Daily Show correspondent who hosted last summer while Jon Stewart directed his movie, now has his own show of political satire on HBO called Last Week Tonight. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Child's dream of a better future carried on a boat he built with his own hands.
I crossed the river on a small raft. All I was doing, God willing, was to make a better future for myself.
Huddled masses of children making the journey to America alone. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Bad energy habits around the office can affect your bottom line. PICO Smart Ideas for Your Business can help with customized tips, information, and programs designed to save you energy and money. Learn more at pico.com/smartideas. PICO supports WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we are, in a sense, jumping off this new Pew Research poll that found that the American public has become much more divided along political and ideological lines in the last 20 years, with Republicans and Democrats viewing each other with increasing mistrust and hostility. And again, our guests are Brendan Nyhan and James Peterson. Let me get Anne from Ardmore to join us on Radio Times. Anne, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
My biggest political problem, and I love to discuss politics, is that two of my favorite brothers are ardent Republicans, while I am ardent Democrat. One is actually a Tea Partier, and the other is just your plain ordinary Republican. But we have come to the conclusion that if we want to preserve our relationship, we cannot talk politics.
Really?
At all.
And you've tried it? You've tried it, Anna, and it doesn't work?
We've tried it. It doesn't work. I posted something on Facebook that my Tea Party brother didn't like, and he said I ruined Facebook for him. Now, I replied, if you don't like it, you don't have to read it.
Right.
But still, I mean, that's just, he's, you know, it's all or nothing for him. But it's horrible because, and I wonder if your guests would comment on the apparent tendency of military or former military officers to be more Republican than anything else.
Brother is. Well, and let me just take the brother family situation and actually toss that first to Brendan Nyhan. And, I mean, with family, you know, you don't get to choose so much as you do with your friends. So you can often end up with a family with a lot of different political ideas.
That's right. That's right. And it can be uncomfortable. It would be nice if we could have these conversations, of course, but sometimes we have to reach these sort of understandings too, right? I mean, the political system, we shouldn't expect that we can always resolve our disagreements because in a lot of cases there is no resolving them. The reason we have politics is because we can't agree on everything, right?
Right.
So I'm sympathetic to the concern. I have people I wish I could talk about politics more effectively with as well, but at the same time, I think we should just look for opportunities to find common ground
exactly.
with people. And it may not be every person, it may not be every relationship, but there may be ways to challenge yourself. And I guess the thing I would just say is we all should think more carefully about how we ourselves can be more open to other viewpoints and more accepting, and less thinking about the ways in which other people have failed to listen to us, of course is the tendency we all have.
Of course it is. Yeah, go ahead, James.
I would agree, especially because it's the caller's family. I think it's worth actually taking stock of which issues are the flashpoints, because there may be more common ground than you think if you get beyond these sort of flashpoint issues. I don't know the data on this, but I haven't seen any information that suggests that veterans are necessarily more conservative or more Republican than they are a Democrat. Certainly as someone who comes from a military family, you know, my father, you know, brothers, sisters, they're not coming out of the military and becoming Tea Partiers or becoming conservative. So I think we should probably get a little bit more data and information on that to figure that out. But because it is your family, I think it's worth it to actually identify what the flashpoint issues are, maybe try to avoid those, and then maybe you can talk about some things you might have more common ground on.
And I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let's see what Nancy from South Philadelphia has to say. Nancy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have friends on both sides of the political divide, and I'm horrified at how how hostile they are to the other side. You know, I end up being having, I argue some, but I have to be relatively patient with them.
Uh-huh.
And I'm really kind of horrified because the world did not used to be like this.
And it feels what there's more sort of overt hostility? Is that what you're seeing,
more
Nancy?
More conviction that the other side is just plain evil.
Oh, evil. Not just wrong, but evil.
Yeah, bad motives. And I wonder if there's been any research on how many relationships have been lost over politics and whether there's a trend there.
Well, yeah, I don't know whether there's research on that, but I think you raise an interesting point, which I think the Pew study does as well, which is that viewing the other side as a threat to the nation. James
yeah, the Pew Research study is pretty clear that although there's more Republicans than Democrats who feel this way, it's been on the rise on both sides, that people who are in the extreme sort of wings of these parties feel that the other party is actually detrimental or sinister. And again, we can talk about certain issues. You know, for folk on the left, you think about, you know, warfare, how wars are prosecuted. You think about the economic policy. They think those things are detrimental to the country, and maybe there's some evidence for that. On the other side of the spectrum, you know, there are lots of folk on the right who feel like the social safety net's sinking the economy. I don't agree with that, but that's what they feel. And so if you're in support of the social safety net, if you're in support of the Affordable Care Act, they believe that that's detrimental to the economy. So there are some legitimate political reasons, at least from the perspective of these ideological wings, that suggest that. I don't think that's as outlandish as it appears to be. It's not like they're saying that the parties want to bomb the nation, but they're looking at policies, macro policies that actually do shape specific outcomes in the nation.
Let me pick up on that. And Brendan, to you, I just scribbled down the words climate change. I mean, that's where you see a huge, what appears to be a really big ideological divide. And on one side of that divide are something like 98% of the scientists and science organizations. How do we wrestle through something like that?
Well, that's a great example of how polarization can lead us astray. The science is very clear and has become increasingly clear even as our politics have become more polarized. So if you actually look at the data over time, you can see the two parties polarizing in their level of belief in climate change, with Republicans actually going down even as the science becomes stronger. And I think that's an unfortunate reflection of the ways both that our partisanship can influence what we believe, but also the ways that our elites and institutions can do a disservice to people who, of course, can't puzzle through the science themselves and shouldn't be expected to. But we need elites that give people at least fact-based information. We can have an argument. We can have a disagreement about how do you handle climate change? How do you address it? What policies should we take, if any, maybe to alleviate it? But the scientific fact of rising global temperatures is, I think at this point an absolute consensus.
But the science doesn't matter to those on the right, because again, it's a political issue masquerading as something else. I mean, the reality is that what we do about climate change affects energy policy, affects things that those on the right are protective of in terms of sort of economic interests. And so the reality is you're right. It would be great to set aside the science and say, hey, this is just what the science says. But the Republicans in this way are already one step ahead of that, because what they're really responding to is what needs to happen if you acknowledge that climate change is in place. Because things like cap and trade, things like the XL pipeline, all the sort of issues around energy and how we sort of get energy, fracking, all those things then are now on the table once you can see climate change.
Let me go back to you, Brandon, but picking up on that, you know, a picture of a polar bear stranded on an ice floor or something, that seems to resonate with people, or even pictures of glaciers shrinking. Are visual representations, are they particularly persuasive in an argument or a discussion, a disagreement?
You know, they can be. I've done research that suggests that showing people a graphical representation of the temperature trends and showing how consistent they are across a different set of four different sets of measurements can be more persuasive than telling people in textual form. So there may be ways visual representations are more powerful. But at the same time, I would say that some of these things, like the polar bear on the ice floe, which has been used so many times in climate change, may not actually be effective. It may be effective to the people who are already persuaded by climate change and getting them to care more about the issue. But that's actually a different question than what would persuade someone who doesn't believe climate change is going on. And again, I think in some ways this, the concern is being directed at the wrong level. We need institutions that hold people accountable when they say things that aren't accurate based on the science. And you know, that's something the media can do for politicians and public figures when they mislead people about the science. The public isn't going to be reading the scientific studies, and again, I don't think we should expect them to. So
right.
We should try to give people good information, but we should also avoid this, you know, essentially blaming the victim for you know, the ways that they've been misled about what the data really say.
The science is very compelling. It may not be interesting, but it's very compelling. And again, I feel like we're talking about the wrong things. It's really much more political than trying to get people to understand that climate change is happening. It's about really understanding what are the slate of issues that have to be on the table if you acknowledge that climate change is real. Those folk on the right that are not going to acknowledge, there's no amount of science that's going to convince them.
Or polar bears on ice floes.
That's not going to convince them, because what you have to do is we have to find the political way to talk about the issues that they're most concerned about, and that's about energy policy and about the future of energy policy, and there's a lot of economic interest that's tied in that actually is situated on the right.
Let me get Bilal from Chester County to join us on Radio Times. Bilal, go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
You all.
Thanks.
Can you quantify the number of people that are polarized to the extreme? Is it 10%, 20%?
It's about
20% on each side. What's the number?
What's the number? You're saying something
Pew,
like 20? Yeah, go ahead, Brendan.
Oh, sorry, I have it in front of me.
The
Pew study says the percentage of Democrats with political values that are consistently liberal is 23%,
yeah.
And then and another 33% are mostly liberal. So you have 56% of Democrats who are either mostly or consistently liberal, and then you have 53% of Republicans who are either mostly or consistently conservative.
So
a majority of both parties.
Does that make sense to you?
It does. I mean, it's that's the ideological siloing that we're thinking about. Again, I would love to see some of this research thought about in the context of how the political spectrum has shifted. You know, and again, I believe that shift has been to the right. And I think if you look at, again, war policy, you look at what the response to the Affordable Care Act, if you look at how we think about the social safety net, all of those things have moved to the right in the latter half of the 20th century, and certainly that's manifesting itself in the 21st century.
Let me get Judy from Wilmington, Delaware, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Judy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Actually, I've been concerned about this with relation to who is benefiting from having our citizens at each other's throats. I feel like the antagonism in this country has reached almost pre-Civil War heights. Mm. And I keep wondering, why is this? You know, why is there some kind of an orchestrated effort to keep us distracted and angry with each other? I just would like to know if there's anything in the Pew research findings addressing this issue.
Or even what our guests are thinking about it, since you're sitting across from me, James Peterson.
Well, there's nothing in the Pew research
that
talks about this. And I'm not a one who's prone to conspiracies, but I do think that there are political classes and economic classes that benefit from the policy paralysis, particularly of this the current Congress, the current form of government. And if you think about just along income inequality sort of metrics, it seems to me that the wealthiest in this nation certainly economically, I don't know if they ideologically benefit, but they economically benefit from the status quo and the kind of paralysis that we see from money in politics, from the limited discourse around political issues. You know, income inequality is one measure that there is a group of people who benefit. Whether that's a direct benefit or not is at least one of the consequences of the kind of political paralysis that we see.
But Brendan, what I hear in Judy's question is a frustration on her part, and maybe even a worry about the fact that people, a certain percentage of the people, are so angry at each other about the state of the country.
Yeah, no, there is a group where politics is a increasingly visceral sort of aspect of people's lives, for this small sliver of the population at least. And you know, in a lot of ways, I think we should think of you mentioned sports earlier. And, you know, I think we should think in a lot of ways of the way people are following the parties as being more sports like being teams. A sports fan, right? Right. The level of bias you have when the ref makes a call against your side, right? You know, we have this ideal of voters as dispassionately, considering the evidence and deciding who to vote for based on the facts. But we're much more like fans than we are rational information processors when it comes to politics. And again, for this small group of people who are the equivalent of the hardcore sports fans, that's increasingly true. And then that's the kind of – you can think of the extremes of the sports fans out there and the ways in which that can become pathological, right? There's a similar kind of –
Hey, you're talking to people in Philadelphia.
Yeah, oh, right. No, that's right. The D-batters are hailing down on me from the top of Veterans Stadium, right?
Exactly.
So, right. So, and, I love sports, too. Sports is great. And I love politics. And, we have to find the appropriate – limits and again, I think our problems as a country are less about those. Like, we've had polarized politics before, right. And our democracy is still here.
Right.
The problem isn't the public being polarized so much. It's how do we make the government work when we have ideology and party so closely aligned in this political system that lets either party basically block action if they try hard enough. And that's the question we're going to have to confront going forward, and that's not one that any one of us can solve.
No,
we know at least one answer to that question, though, which is to decrease the impact that money has on politics.
You think it would make a difference?
I do think it would make a difference. I think that if we wanted particularly the House of Representatives to be more representative, we'd have to look at a lot of issues. We'd have to look at gerrymandering. We'd have to look at certain policies of the Congress and the Senate. But we'd also have to look at how financing informs and shapes the political discourses and the issues that we're able to talk about on national levels.
We're almost out of time here, and I hate to throw a gender thing in here, but my understanding is that a lot of the women senators, Republican and Democrat, meet on a regular basis. I'm looking at you, James Peterson, meet on a regular basis and talk about stuff. Now, I don't know, is that a model going forward? Do girls do this better than boys?
Well, there are studies that show that women are different kinds of leaders, that the kind of discourse that women engage in can be more consensus-oriented and can be more pragmatic, a little bit less ideological. Lots of great sociolinguistic studies about the ways in which women talk versus the ways in which men talk. So I think there is some there that women in leadership roles will help to break some of the gridlock. But some of it is just about gender issues. There are so many issues that we're talking about here where women have to be at the table because their issues are primary and can inform the process.
Well, we could go on. We have to end our discussion. My thanks to both of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Brendan Nyhan, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me. Dan.
You're welcome. And he's assistant professor in the Department of Government at Dartmouth College, writes for the Upshot blog for the New York Times. James Peterson, thank you very much as well.
Thank you, Marty.
And director of Africana Studies and associate professor of English at Lehigh University, founder of Hip Hop Scholars. He's got a book coming out later this year, a contributor to MSNBC. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including podcasts and Facebook, Twitter, and how to sign up for our newsletter. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.